I haven't even said anything yet. My name is Paul, and I'm a full-blown alcoholic. I'm amazed at the number of drunks in Mount Vernon. I didn't realize, sitting down there, I didn't realize people were standing. I always feel bad about people that have to stand. And then a little voice says to me, "What the hell? You've got to stand." I was really impressed walking in here tonight. This is quite a establishment. And it's rather unusual, open air pews and this big table like affair in the front with a bunch of poker chips at one end. Yeah. Seemed rather strange, but I've seen a lot of strange things in AA, and I'm delighted to be here tonight. I think this is just terrific. I'm really, really glad to be here. Of course, alcoholics always say that. They're glad to be any place. I'm glad to be here. I'm glad Bill invited me over. I was listening to the readings. I always listen carefully to the readings because there's always the there's always a chance that I'll hear something, a different inflection or a different emphasis on something and about the way something's read. You get some new meaning out of it. But I also listen for the mistakes. I love to hear the mistakes that are made, like the person that says, "What an odor, I can't go through with it." And and the woman who said, "Half measures are available." But the one I liked best was in the traditions, when he read it as the only requirement for membership is a desire to start drinking. Somehow that seemed more realistic than the way it's written. A little more honest. Yeah. And Bill opened the thing with a serenity prayer. And it reminded me, Max and I went to a place in, I think it was Colorado, and they were having a fundraiser on a Saturday. They had a speaker at noon, and then a meal, and then some other things going on. And they'd had it the year before, and it had been rather successful. They had 150 people attend, so they're going to try and do it this year, and have at least as many. But as they were rolling along, and after they invited the speakers and so on, the committee that was putting it on got what they referred to as a resentment. I don't suppose you have those out here, but they decided they were so resentful they weren't going to put the fair on. They quit. That was the end of it. There wasn't going to be any fundraiser that year. Well, the rest of the people got a resentment at them having a resentment, and they decided they'd go ahead and put on the fair themselves. By God, they didn't. And they formed their own committee to put the fair on, and they decided they were going to double it and have 300. And they put it on, they worked real hard and advertised a lot. And it turned out it was more than successful. They had 500 show up. Well, that put a strain on the caterer who was getting the food ready. And they said they could do it, but it was going to be a little delay. And the other problem they had was that the local minister had been invited to put on to give the invocation, and he hadn't shown up. So they went to one of the old timers there, and they said, "If the minister doesn't show up, will you give the invocation?" And he said, "Well, yeah." And he started thinking about what he would say. And meanwhile, they were trying to get the meal ready, getting the food going. And it was getting later and later. The old timer was making more and more notes on what he was going to say at the invocation. finally, the caterer was ready and said the food was ready to go, and the people all wanted to get up and go eat. And they said, no, you can't eat yet. You have to have the invocation. So he called the old timer up, and he got up to the podium, and he took out his notes and started to read, and the first word was God. And he said, God, and they all recited the Serenity Prayer and ran for the food. Yeah. So I guess the moral of the story is, if you're going to give an invocation to a bunch of hungry alcoholics, don't bring God in it too soon. You know. I was happy when they started to clap when the people were being called up to the podium. We're used to doing that in Southern California. We clap for everything. We clap for people to get up to go to the John. Another thing we do is different. You ask for people at their very, very first AA meeting, which is fine, but we're not quite that easy on new people. We ask for people with 30 days or less of current sobriety to have them stand up. But maybe we could do that tonight. Would you raise your hands if you have 30 days or less of sobriety? Let's see how many new people we have. That's terrific. That's terrific. We're really glad you're here. We're really glad you're here. And we don't even care that you're not glad you're here. In fact, if you're thrilled to death to be here, and you think there's nothing you'd rather do than come to an AA meeting every night for the rest of your life, and you thought this was just terrific, we might not be able to help you. But if you think you're in the wrong place, well, you're in the right place. And if you think this doesn't belong, your case is different. If you think your case is different, that makes you one of us. Being happy you're here is not a requirement. We're glad enough for you. You don't need to be happy too. As a matter of fact, I found out Max and I live in Laguna Niguel, and next door a town is Laguna Beach, and I found out that Laguna Beach has a bark park. Now, before I start into that, I better tell you that we have two Alla dogs. Lily and Sabrina. Lily is a little white Bichon Frise, and Sabrina is a little black Shih Tzu. And they don't like other dogs. In fact, Sabrina particularly hates other dogs. And the bigger they are, the more she wants to beat them up. And it makes it impractical to take her out walking and have her want to beat up all the neighborhood dogs, especially when she's supposed to be so serene and practice good Al-Anonism. I found out that Laguna Beach has a bark park, and the bark park is a large park, about twice the size of this, has a large chain link fence around it, and the entrance to it is a double entry. You go through one gate, and in there it's like a little room, and you take off the dog's leashes, and then you walk through the next door gate, and the dogs run free in this large park. And the idea is that if somebody says that when you take the leash off a dog, they lose a lot of their aggressiveness. And they say that if you come there two or three visits or so, they get over whatever aggressiveness they have, and they learn to play with other dogs, and they learn to be sociable with other dogs. And I thought, well, this sounds great, but I wonder. So I thought I'll try it. So on a Sunday afternoon, I took Lily and Sabrina in the car and took them down to the Mark Park. And as we drove up, oh, there must have been 36 dogs of all sizes, shapes, colors, running around, chasing frisbees and chasing each other and barking and playing doggy games. And I don't know about this. But I went in the first gate and I took the leashes off. And with considerable trepidation, we all went through the next gate. And they were terrified. The two dogs were terrified. And as we got in there, a little white male dog came up to them, to us, sniffed us all over real good, and walked along wherever we went. It went with us. It had a very, very calming effect on Lily and Sabrina. And as a matter of fact, at one time, two big dogs playing tag or whatever and barking at each other came running by, yelling and hollering and making a lot of noise. It scared Sabrina. Sabrina started yelling at them, and this little white dog started yelling at him too. Much as to say, be careful, there's a lady here. You know. And after a while, he had to leave. And a big, long-haired black dog took his place. And everywhere we went, he went. In fact, I decided to walk the periphery of the park so the dogs would get familiar with it. And we walked the full periphery of it. And the two dogs followed me along. And this dog followed us along and went right along with, much as to say, don't worry, it's okay. It's okay. And eventually, he had to leave. And, yeah, it's a long story. has to be a moral here someplace. I guess what I'm trying to say is, if you're new here tonight, you'll never have to go anywhere alone again. I mean, whatever you have to walk through, we'll walk through it with you if you're willing to ask us for help. I mean, I'm convinced we can keep anybody sober if they're willing to accept enough help in walking through life with us. At least so it's worked with me. It's a we program. First word of the first step is we. And that's very meaningful to me. And I like that part of AA. I like all parts of AA, I guess. I love AA. I love this way of life. I'm very enthusiastic about this way of life. I'm enthusiastic about life. I'm even enthusiastic about the word enthusiasm. The N means within, and Theos means God. It refers to the God within. And I feel that my higher power likes it when I am enthusiastic about the way of life he has given me. I think that's the way I show my gratitude to him, by being enthusiastic about the life he has given me. And that even when I don't feel enthusiastic, I tend to act enthusiastic, because if I act enthusiastic, I tend to become enthusiastic. So I can fake it till I make it. And as I say, I think my higher power likes that. I know he does. And So I love enthusiasm. In fact, even if somebody's doing something wrong, if they're doing it with enthusiasm, by God, I'm kind of for them, you know? It helps a lot. And it's surprising to me that I am so enthusiastic about sobriety and this way of life and about being an alcoholic. I'm so enthusiastic about this way of life that I'm enthusiastic about being an alcoholic. I love being an alcoholic. And if that gives you any problems, so be it. If you have a problem with me saying I love being an alcoholic, talk to your sponsor. If your sponsor can't explain it to you, get a new sponsor. If you don't have a sponsor, shame on you. It's surprising that I am so enthusiastic about being an alcoholic and about AA way of life when I wasn't even an alcoholic when I came here. I wasn't at all. I wasn't an alcoholic. I wasn't an alcoholic until I was come to AA for 7 months. I originally came to AA with a brain tumor. And there's nothing funny about a brain tumor. It did occur to me the other day that AA is not only taking care of my alcoholism, it took care of my brain tumor. But I originally came here, I was in the nut ward of the hospital. I was on the staff buff, and I was there by mistake. Wasn't very funny at all. There was a series of mistakes and misdiagnoses and poor medical management and bad breaks. But I was in the hospital of the nut ward of the hospital. I was on staff of. In fact, it was a very boring place to be. They, for one thing, they insisted on me learning how to make leather belts. They not only insisted that I make leather belts, they insisted that I agree that my life would be greatly improved if I learned how to make leather belts. Which made no sense to me at all. In fact, I explained it to him. I told him that I have a wall. I have a wall with diplomas and licenses and certificates and papers to prove that I've been educated way beyond my level of intelligence, and that and I couldn't see how knowing how to make leather belts would improve my life in any way. I didn't understand the philosophy, and besides, I didn't understand the instructions. And then, well, that wasn't my fault. That's the fault of the occupational therapist. I've always had a theory. If you don't understand a thing well enough, so you explain it to me so that I understand it, and you don't understand it as well as you're supposed to. And she'd already explained it 3 times. And I wasn't going to embarrass her by asking her a 4th time. I remember, and that's a strange thing too. I remember I was sitting there commiserating with myself about the series of mistakes, misunderstandings, misdiagnoses, and poor medical management that had ended up with a nice guy like me in a place like that. And this dumb psychiatrist who couldn't see that my problems were strictly marital, walked up behind me and he said, ask me, would I mind talking to a man from Alcoholics Anonymous? And I thought to myself, my God, Doc, don't I have enough problems of my own without trying to help some drunk from AA? You know? I didn't know anything about alcoholics and alcoholism, and didn't want to know anything about it. I just knew that I didn't want to treat a lot of alcoholics, because if you treat one, they'll all start coming to you. And then if they all start coming to you, then all the good patients will stop coming to you. And besides, the alcoholics never make appointments and don't keep them when they have them and don't pay their bills anyhow. But I could tell by the look on his face that he thought it was a good idea. I could tell that he thought it was a good idea. And I don't know if you know or not, but happiness on a nut ward is having a happy psychiatrist. And I was willing to go to any length to make him happy. And so I said yes. And in no time at all, this clown comes galloping into the room yelling, my name is Frank and I'm an alcoholic. Ha, 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 ha. I felt sorry for him. Here he's meeting a perfect stranger, and the only thing he could think about himself was that he was an alcoholic. I was a lot more impressed when I found out he was an attorney. And like an attorney, he had an interminable story and a loud voice, just yelling about us alcoholics and Alcoholics Anonymous and all us drunks. And I kept thinking, my God, man, why don't you lower your voice? And these people all think I'm a nut. Why don't we leave it at that? You know. And outside of his story being interminable and loud, I don't remember a word of it. I don't remember a word that he said, except I remember that he finally ended by saying, well, that's my story. I'm going to a meeting tonight. Would you like to go along? And I said, hell no, I won't like it. But I'll go, because I figured he'd go back and talk, squeal that dumb psychiatrist. And he would have. And I went to a meeting. And I have no idea what meeting we went to, or who led, or who read, or who prayed, or who did anything, or how many meetings. I don't even know how many meetings we went to before I knew what meeting I was at. But I know that meeting had a profound effect on the psychiatrist. He wanted to know all about it, and he wanted to know, what's this about steps, what's this about books, what other kind of meetings do they have, how often do they have meetings, when are you going back to meet again? And all these questions, I thought, my God, I've got me an alcoholic psychiatrist. And he's ashamed to go, so he's sending me. Yeah. And I wondered how many meetings I'd have to go to before I could get him sober so I could go home. Yeah. And I actually went to meetings thinking that, you know, as a physician, these people have been so down and out, and they're now lifting themselves by their bootstraps and doing something with their lives. I think it's a nice civic duty of me to go to these meetings and support them in this mutual uplift thing that they're doing, which is offhand I would think, well, that's a reflection of my basic humility, but also, you know, in a sense though, I was going there to help others, and I ended up sober and still am, and so there must have been something good about that. Even though it's doing the right thing for the wrong motive, which works in AA. Thank God that works in AA. Yeah. As a matter of fact, come to think of it, last Sunday was my 27th AA birthday. And you're applauding AA, of course. And but I'm impressed, but you're not nearly as impressed as I am. In 27 years, it's a long time between drinks for me. I have never gone that long without a drink. And the strange thing about it is I don't even want a drink. And it's in fact, if I'd have known 27 years ago last Sunday that was my last drink, I think I would have drunk more or something. I didn't think, well, this is it. I'm not going to drink for 27 years. You know, never occurred to me. Eh? And I was carried away with the idea that, what happened? Let me go back to when I became an alcoholic. I was coming to AA for 7 months. And what happened, I had no intentions of continuing to go when I got out of the hospital, but Max, my wife, I should explain that Max is short for Maxine. That's my wife. I confuse people a lot when I fail to mention that sometimes. I talk about sleeping with Max. I had no intentions of continuing to go to these meetings because I wasn't an alcoholic. Why should I? But Max liked the meetings. And of course, once I found out she liked them, and then I would use that against her and to control her. And if she didn't behave right, I would say, well, I'm not going to meetings anymore. I'm not going to AA anymore. I said that once too often. And she got in the car and she drove all the way from Laguna Beach down to, we lived in Anaheim. And we drove down to Laguna Beach, about 45 minutes away on the freeway. And she couldn't drive the freeway, but she did it anyway. She went to meetings by herself. And I found myself sitting at home on Saturday night drinking, while my non-alcoholic spouse is off laughing it up at an AA meeting. And I found that boring, and that I was also curious as to what they laughed about. And so I had to go back to the AA meetings to see what they were all the time laughing about. And I found out that alcoholics laugh at anything. They laugh at nothing. They laugh at things they ought to be embarrassed about, you know. One night I found myself laughing with them, and I haven't had a drink since. I find that to me the laughter is very therapeutic. In fact, I am convinced that my higher power laughs every time he hears AA's and Al-Anon's laugh, even if he doesn't understand the joke. Yeah. I think there's a lot of spirituality in laughter. And so that's how I turned into being an alcoholic. And once I became an alcoholic, then I had the problem of not drinking, because I noticed in AA, most people don't drink. In fact, the people that are happy seem to be the ones that are not drinking, which is kind of a paradox, I thought. And in fact, none of the winners drink. I haven't found it. In fact, I remember asking Chuck C. one time, what's a winner? He's an old-timer, as Bill mentioned, and I thought he'd whip off an answer right off, but he didn't. He hesitated. Then he said, well, I guess you have to die sober. Die sober? Hell, I wanted to be a winner, but I wasn't planning on dying. Do you? This idea of dying to get recognition never appealed to me. You know? So I thought, well, I'll focus on living as a winner. And then I thought, well, a winner must be a successful member of AA. So I just set out to be a successful member of AA. And my definition of success varied from time to time, but it was always whatever appealed to me. It wasn't I was trying to convince anybody else. I just wanted to be a success in my own mind. And I hadn't seen any successful members of AA who drank, so that meant I had to quit. But I was afraid to quit because I had quit many, 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 many times. And every time I quit drinking, I had ended up drunk. And I finally came to the conclusion that quitting drinking was really hard on my health. And so I thought, well, here I am, an alcoholic, and I don't want to drink, but I'm afraid to quit. And then I remembered some of this stupid heard during this 7 months, things like, well, if you don't take a drink today, you won't get drunk today. And it's the first drink that gets us drunk. I never got drunk on the first drink, never in my life. And and then people say, we don't quit, we just don't drink one day at a time. I thought, that's so simplistic and stupid. What good would it do to not drink for one day, for God's sake? But I didn't know what else to do. So I thought, well, I won't tell anybody, but I just won't drink today and see what happens. And nothing happened. So I decided to try it another day, and nothing happened that day. You know. And I've been doing that ever since. And today's a very important day for me. Today's the day I don't drink. Never drink today. Gonna drink tomorrow, for sure. In fact, I don't know that I could keep from drinking today if I didn't know I was gonna drink tomorrow. Right. But when tomorrow gets here, I'll check the time. And if it's today, I won't drink today. Yeah. Anyway, that and thousands, I guess, of meetings, and having a sponsor, and reading the book, working the steps, doing everything I'm asked to do in AA, a lot of things I'm not asked to do, has kept me sober. In fact, I have redone all of the steps. I'm always living the steps, but I have redone all of them. I figured it out the other day. It averaged out every 5 years. I have this pamphlet that the group of us go through. We study the first 164 pages of the book, and when we come to a step, we do it. It's not a step study, it's a step do it. And the thing I've noticed is that every time I've done that, every time I've redone all the steps, I've gone to a new plateau in my sobriety, just like the very first time I did them. It's been a great experience for me. I'm not saying anybody else should do it. I'm just saying that's what I've done, and it's worked for me so far. And so everything I've done has worked for me so far, so I'm going to keep on doing it. And as I say, I find it easy to not drink, and don't even want to drink today. And I don't have any problems today as a result of drinking. I haven't had any problems as a result of drinking since the last time I took a drink. My problems today, I have a dual problem. I not only have a drinking problem, I have a thinking problem. My sponsor says, Paul, don't drink and don't think. And I don't even have a problem today unless I think I do. But doesn't matter what you think, it's what I think, you know. If I think I got a problem, I've got a problem. I've never ever thought I had a problem and been wrong. You know, I alone determine whether or not I have a problem. I alone determine the size of my problems. If I think it's a big problem, it's a big problem. And if I think it's just a little problem, no matter what you think, just a little problem. I don't have many little problems. I don't bother with them. You know, it's like resentments. I don't bother with any but the justifiable ones. Besides, if I have a little problem, all I have to do is think about it. Because my mind is a tremendous energy factory. And it puts out this energy in a sharp focus, like a laser beam or an ultraviolet light or a searchlight. It goes through the dark. Oh, that's an interesting problem you've got there. Can I borrow it for a while? You know, you rest, I'll carry it, you know. I can take any little bitty problem and just think about it. In fact, I don't even have to start with a problem. I can start with a non-problem. Well, that's no problem. Oh, I suppose if you thought about it, it could be a little bit of a problem. The more I think about it, the more it gets fascinating. You know, I'm pretty soon I'm thinking, by God, it's a good thing I'm looking at this. You know. Pretty soon I'm thinking, it's a good thing I'm looking at this. Everybody else is missing it. You know. I just get fascinated. And people can't even help you much with a problem like that. They tell you dumb things. They say, well, don't think about it. Well, how are you going to not think about it? That's what a problem is, something to think about, you know. I've always believed in the positive power of worry. You know, you worry hard enough about something, you can keep it from happening. And I could give you thousands of illustrations of things that never happened because I worried about them. And it seems to me that my life consists of a conflict for my competing for my attention, a competition between problems and program. Problems always want to get my attention. And they love to get me in the spot where somebody says, are you going to the meeting tonight? Oh no, I can't go tonight. I've got to work on this problem. I don't have time for the program. I've got to work on the problem. And the worst thing I can do with the problem is work on it. Because work on it means think about it. Yeah. And watch it grow, you know. What I need to do is get over here on the program and have people call on the phone. I always give out my phone number. We live in the 714 area, and the number is 240-3940. And I get phone calls from people with little bitty problems, you know. And it takes me away from my problem, and I get over here talking about their problem. And you have to take time with people. You can't just brush them off. You have to do active listening. That's what they call it. Any therapist will tell you, you do active listening. Now, that means you ask questions. You act interested is what that means, you know. You ask questions, you say, oh, and then what did you do? Oh, and how did you feel about that? You know. And then what happened? Oh, tell me more, you know. You keep them talking about it until neither one of you can stand it anymore, you know. And eventually then you give them the answer. You know, what's the answer? The answer, you pick a number from 1 to 12. You know, they work that step, you know. It really doesn't matter what number. I mean, to get out of order, they'll find that out and do them right. Doesn't matter. Except if you pick 4 or 5. I mean, you lose a lot of people that way, you know. Hell, if they're not going to work the steps, you can't sponsor them anyway. That's what you're sponsoring them to. So anyway, and then by the time I get back to my problem, the stupid thing has left. I mean, the problems are very fickle. They will leave and go to somebody who will give them more attention. And the thing about problems with me is that the committee in my head loves to talk about them. They love to debate them and argue back and forth about how I should handle them. And keep telling me, well, no, you got to keep thinking about this, because if you keep thinking about it, you'll finally think of an answer. What actually happens for me is when I stop thinking about it and work in the program, the answer comes to me intuitively. But the committee loves to talk about it. I don't know if you know about my committee, but maybe you don't have a committee. But that's the way I think. That's the way I think. I have a committee. They're in my head. There are probably as many people up there as there are in here. And I got personalities I haven't even met yet, you know. And you're sitting here very quietly. They're up there talking. That's all they do is talk. You talk. Never do any work. They just talk. And now they make suggestions of what I ought to talk about. I'm trying to have some continuity of what I'm talking to you about, and they're making suggestions of various things to talk about. And which is okay, except then they get to fighting among themselves about whether I should talk about that or not. You know, and it gets very disorganized. I mean, shut up there. And they all shut up, and I can't think of anything to say. You know. An odd thing about that is, in fact, one of the most troublesome is if I used to have to use alcohol and drugs and stuff to get them to go to sleep so I could sleep at night. And it took so much drugs to get them all asleep that I couldn't get them awake in the morning. And then I took so much to get them awake in the morning, I had to take other stuff to calm them down. In fact, I took quite a few. I never became a pill head, but I took some medicinal pills. I never got hooked on them, though. I never got hooked on them, because you ask any doctor, and he'll tell you the only way you can get hooked on pills, on his pills, is to abuse them. You have to abuse the pill. I don't even know how to abuse a pill. Well, how do you abuse a pill? You throw it up against the wall, you know. Yeah. Or stomp on the darn thing, you know. Or maybe verbally abuse it. You dirty, rotten little pill. Why didn't you do what I told you? No, I was very solicitous with my pills. They were very tiny little pills. I mean, just to look at them, you could tell they were very mild. And I didn't care for where I carried them. I used to carry more with my change. People say, "You got change for a dollar?" And I say, "Oh, yeah." And I feel like that. They say, "Oh, you carry second all around in the daytime." You know. I put it over with my keys. And I go out in the parking lot and I take the keys out of my pocket. And a Quaalude would run down the street, you know. Damn thing would always run faster than I could run, you know. And I didn't dare stomp on it or I'd abuse it. You know, I was very solicitous of my pills. I never ever took a pill unless I had the symptom. I did. I either had it or I could feel it coming on. So anyway. But and I was talking about getting to bed at night. A lot of times I'd get through and want to go home and lie down, and my body would be tired and want to sleep. And my brain would say, no, let's lie here and talk about it for a while. You know? And I think, even if I did get to sleep, about 3:30, 4 o'clock, they'd wake me up and say, hey, wake up. We've had an emergency meeting and we need to talk to you. Yeah. You know that thing that you thought went so well today? It wasn't like that at all, you know. They're really ticked off at you. Wait till morning, you'll find out, you know. And I don't want to listen to that, and I roll over and go back to sleep. And just as I was about to lose consciousness, I'd think, boy, I'm sure glad I'm not thinking about that anymore. Yeah. And one of them say, well, I'm glad you're still awake. You know, that's not the only... Yeah. That's not the only time you did that. About 6 months ago, you did the same dumb thing. In fact, you've done a lot of dumb things. And in fact, let's spend the rest of the night making lists of dumb things you have done. Yeah. Anyhow, but the point I wanted to make was, in the middle of all that committee and all that confusion and all that noise, in the very, very center of me, in the very, very center of me, there's a center of calm, the center of absolute calm. And that's where my higher power is. And that's where he's always been. And I didn't know that. And not knowing that is the same as having it not be true. You can't make use of it until you know it. And that's very comforting to me, to know that I can't go anyplace or do anything that my higher power isn't with me. And that, I find that very comforting. And I've gotten very comfortable with all the personalities in my head. I don't fight them anymore. They're friends of mine. Yes, they are. They may, even the ones that have lewd and illegal, and geez, I'm glad you can't hear some of the suggestions they make. But I don't fight them anymore. I'm friendly with them. And the fact is, some poet was talking about defects and things like that, and he called them demons. And he said, hug your demon. Hug your demon. Otherwise, it'll bite you in the ass. Yeah. I didn't say that. The poet said that, you know. I don't talk like that. But you know how these poets are. That's the way it is with my higher power. I'm going to have to get down from here. I'm sure you're happy to hear. Two things I want to say. Father Barney used to come down from Seattle to our area and put on retreats for Alcoholics and Al-Anons. He said a lot of good things. One of the things he said that I liked particularly was that he liked to break sobriety down into its parts, just like I like to break sobriety into a day at a time. He broke sobriety down into kinds of sobriety. And he said it was like a baseball diamond. He said that first base is physical sobriety, second base is mental sobriety, third base is emotional sobriety, and home plate is spiritual sobriety. And I like that. In fact, I like to add marital sobriety. And I thought to myself, how did I get to first base without the spiritual part? And somebody pointed out to me the obvious. He said, you can't get to first base without starting at home plate. I thought, well, that's good. And it seems to me that I see the steps on the diamond. That right beyond physical sobriety or first base is the first step. We admitted we're powerless over alcohol. And secondly, that's where the second step is, just before it or just after it. We came to believe that power greater self could restore us to sanity. And the rest of the steps are on the rest of that diamond. And it seems to me that we spend all of recovery on that diamond moving. We're either moving further into more spiritual sobriety or unconsciously or consciously drifting back toward a drink. We don't stand still, except maybe to change direction. We're always getting more into spiritual sobriety or drifting back toward a drink. And I like that concept. That means I've got to keep moving all the time. I can't stand still. And I've got to keep doing what's working for me. The other thing I wanted to say was, somebody showed me a computer program where you put data in a computer and the computer would make the graphs out of it. They can make a pie graph or a bar graph, a very fancy program. I thought if you had a program, a computer big enough and powerful enough that you could put my life into it and make a graph out of it, I think my life would show as a V. Progressively downhill and then progressively uphill. That from the time I was born until July 31st, 1967, my life was on a downhill course. Now, it wasn't a straight line down, it was up and down. Just enough ups in it to keep me confused and thinking I was getting someplace. But it was, kept going down until I ended up in the nut ward. That wasn't bad enough. I had to go to AA. Yeah. And after 7 months of AA, I accepted the fact that I, through some spiritual error somewhere along the line, I somehow got somebody else's disease by mistake, but I was an alcoholic. And as a matter of fact, the way I see that is that where people are made, there are two lines. One, where people are made, there are the non-drinkers and there are the drinkers. And where the drinkers are coming down the assembly line, there's a little man stands there and he counts from 1 to 10. And every 10th one, he stands, alcoholic, alcoholic, alcoholic. He's been doing that for all of eternity. And then he's kind of bored with the job, as you would be too. And as I was coming down the line, somebody called to him and said, "Hey, Joe." And he says, "What do you want?" And he stamped. He stamped me by mistake. Yeah. 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 I was supposed to be a 9. And, and that's how I became an alcoholic. And true. And on July 31st, 1967, I accepted that fact. Somebody goofed, and poor Joe. And I'm an alcoholic, and that's the way it's going to be. And I accepted that fact, and my life has been getting better and better and better and better ever since. Again, it's not a straight line up. It's up and down. Some days, some weeks, some months, some years are better than others. But the longer trend is up and up. And the only thing I can see that limits how high that can go is how long I can stay around here doing the things that's causing it to go up and up. So there seems to be no end to the end of this the heights to which that can go. This is a spiritual program, and there's no limit to the height, except how long I can keep doing it. And the thing that fascinates me is the point of that. The fact that the power of acceptance, the power of acceptance of that one fact, the fact that I was willing to have the courage to accept that problem and live life to its fullest in spite of the fact I can't drink like other people. And it seems to me that when my attitude of acceptance is working with the power of nature, things get better and better and better. And when my attitude is against the reality of life, it gets worse and worse and worse. This is a tremendous, my attitude has such a tremendous amount to do with which way that force is being used. And it's no wonder I love AA, and it's I don't know, this is a church, and it makes me think, you know, I was taught all my life that when we die, we'll have a pre-admission interview with St. Peter. And he'll ask us, "Have you been good or bad?" Well, I've never met anybody that's been there and said that's what happened. And besides, I was taught he has a black book, and he knows I haven't been good. So I don't think he's going to ask, "Have I been good or bad?" It's my theory, and I love my theory, so if I'm wrong, don't tell me. It's a non-debatable theory. That if we do have a pre-admission interview with St. Peter, I don't think he's going to ask, "Have you been good or bad?" I think he's going to ask, "What was your predominant mood or attitude down there?" And if you say, "Well, what do you want to know that for? What? I thought you want to know about guilt." You say, "I know that's what you were told, but that ain't the truth. I know that you know that this is a place of happiness, peace, and joy. What you don't know is how we keep it that way. For the unhappy, disgruntled, resentful people, we have a special place for them. In fact, you're standing right over the trapdoor. What was your mood while you were down there? You know, and so the point is, I think for the rest of our lives and for all eternity, we better enjoy life, whether we like it or not. Thank you all very much.